There diverged in a wood two roads, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Robert Frost. You think the name of the poem is The Road Less Traveled. It's not. The name of the poem is The Road Not Taken. And for all of its welcome, for all of its being quoted, for all of its popularity, it is also the most misinterpreted poem in history as well. Here's what you think it means. Here's what I thought it meant until I heard somebody write an article who wrote a book on the poem. Here's what we think it means. We come to a fork in the road, and there is something that seems to be a less popular way, and by bold, daring self-assertion, counterintuitively, we go on that way, and that way leads us to life. And that's why everybody quotes it. When you go on Google and you type in that phrase, pictures like the one that shows up on your bulletin show up. A road that is clearly more traversed and a road that is clearly less traversed. And guess which way the guy is going? To the right, on the less traversed way. Brothers and sisters, that's not what the poem is saying. And I didn't know that, so I'm not castigating you. I'm castigating myself. Because if you just read the poem, earlier in the poem it says this, though as for that passing there had warned them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay. It's two roads. They're both trodden. They're both sent the same way. One does not indicate one being more popular than any other. And you thought, he says at the end, that this is a man recollecting upon his life. That this is a person who saw those two ways and now is recalling which way he chose, and now he has found his way. Brothers and sisters, this is not a poem about recollecting. This is a poem about imagining his future. Because later in that poem, just before he says two roads diverged in a wood, he says, I shall be telling this with a sigh. Somewhere ages and ages hence, he's talking about an imaginary future where he's going to tell a story on himself. A story that hasn't happened yet, but a story that he will tell nonetheless. David Orr is a poet. He sometimes writes for the New York Times. He wrote a whole book on this one poem, The Road Not Taken. And he says, if only you will read between the lines, this is not a poem about bold and daring self-assertion. This is a poem, he says, quote, a commentary on the human practice of constructing your own story. It's a commentary, he says, on one's own self-deception when constructing the story of one's own life. This is a poem about learning how to either take too much credit or shift too much blame. It's not about bold and daring self-assertion. All right, who feels deceived?
Speak truth, brother.
I do. And not just about what I thought the poem meant, but maybe also the way I have unwittingly embraced the idea that it connotes, that maybe, in fact, the way less traveled is, that's the way to life. Brothers and sisters, for everybody in this world, we have a theory of life, a theory of how to get to life with a capital L. And every theory that we have implies a certain set of measures that we take, implies a certain kind of restraint that we have to embrace, implies a submission to a way of obedience. Jesus himself, in the text this morning that we're going to talk about, is going to talk about two ways. And just as David Orr has sought to disabuse us all of the misunderstanding of a poem, Jesus, in the passage we're going to look at this morning, is out to disabuse us of what it means to follow him, of certain notions about what it means to follow him, both of those who will not follow in his way and of those who would. He's out to disabuse us of certain preconceived notions that we might have unwittingly internalized. We are in chapter 7, verses 12 through 14. Jesus is out to reimagine for us the very character of obedience. And in looking at these few verses, we're going to find four words that will characterize this obedience: simplicity, difficulty, unpopularity. Those three are nouns. The fourth is an adjective: participatory. The character of obedience involves simplicity, difficulty, unpopularity, and it's also participatory. Let's find out why. We're in chapter 7, verse 12. Would you stand? Matthew 7, starting in verse 12. So whatever you wish that others would do for you, do also to them. For this is the law and the prophets. Enter by the narrow gate. For the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. For those of you who are counting, we have been in the Sermon on the Mount for 22 weeks. Good Lord. Verse 12 summarizes the entirety of it. So why didn't we just do that one on week one, right? Jesus is saying, verse 12 summarizes not just his words on the Sermon on the Mount, but you would say that the essence of what God has disclosed about what he requires of those who follow him. If you get and grasp what verse 12 is saying, you get and grasp God's purpose for humanity. It summarizes the law and the prophets, Jesus says. The same law and prophets that he said back in chapter 5 that he came not to abolish, but to fulfill. And therefore, what summarizes and fulfills all things bears a straightforward simplicity. And he says, therefore, whatever you wish that others would do for you, do also to them. That's it. The NIV kind of likes to clean up the language a little bit by saying, do to others what you would have them do unto you. That's the law and the prophets. It sounds simple. I mean, the prophet Micah, the text that we like to quote hither and yon, what the prophet says God has disclosed to him about the entirety of what goodness entails. He says, what the Lord has shown me, what God requires of us is to act justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly. That's it. And Micah is rightly esteemed for his succinctness. But all of that, for all of its wonder and its splendor and its brevity, is still kind of lives in the abstract. What does it mean to act justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly? Jesus comes along and does even better and says it even more succinctly. To act justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly requires this: that what you require for yourself from others, you would also require from yourself for others. What you require for yourself from others, you must require from yourself for others. That's the law and the prophets. That's the simplicity of the character of obedience. There are allegedly 613 laws in the Old Testament, from which were extrapolated thousands of other interpretations and explanations of what it meant to follow in that way. And just cataloging that 613 alone, one could find oneself thinking this is impossible to walk entirely in his way. It's not even worth the effort. But Jesus is saying this: if you just get what I'm saying in verse 12, you get the rest. You know how to do the rest. It's the controlling principle. And so, therefore, this simplicity has a certain invitation to us all. With a little help from the commentator that we like to appeal to pretty often, F.D. Bruner, he says, The simplicity of this text invites us simply to use a faculty that all of us have that doesn't require that you go to seminary or have any level of education or any level of experience. The faculty that this calls us to all indulge is the faculty of our imagination. Anybody can think. Anybody can wonder. Anybody can think through what they might have to do. If you're not clear what somebody might need in a given moment, you don't have to run to a textbook. You don't have to jump and call on the pastor. All you really need to do first is just ask yourself, what would I need if I'm in that moment? What would I want if I were in their situation? This is, in some ways, riffing on the same motif that Jesus has spoken of earlier in chapter 7 when it came down to taking the log out of your own eye so that you might see clearly how to take the speck out of your brother's eye. That the own practice, that what we call it, the discipline of reflection and repentance, it's that practice that gives you some insight. Insight into the condition of the person who is now before you, who you want to help, but you just don't know how. Is someone in your midst struggling with a sin? Yes, that sin may be complicated in its own right, but the first thing you can do is just ask yourself, what would I want them to do for me in a moment like this? Sometimes people are just waiting for someone to say something that they wish they could say to and believe themselves. Sometimes people are just waiting for someone to do something for them that they wish they could do for themselves. Kids, listen up. You are my heroes, and I'll tell you why. You are my heroes because you sit through these long sermons every Sunday. Believe me, I get my share of grief at around 12:45 every Sunday afternoon. And you might think that anything that takes that long to say, that must mean that obeying Jesus must be something that only adults can do. Because surely anything that goes on for that long is something that only adults are qualified for. Au contraire. Oh no. Jesus is saying something quite different. It doesn't have to be long to be understood. All you have to do to obey Jesus, first of all, is just ask yourself, when you encounter somebody that's having a problem, all you have to say to yourself is, what would I want them to do for me if I were experiencing what they're experiencing? It's that simple. It's that simple. Spouses, can you gather how revolutionary following this simple command would be to enriching your marriages? How many of the arguments that we get into escalate because we refuse to even entertain what might be in the mind and motives of the person with whom we are in an adversarial moment? How many of the lingering issues that we confront would be addressed if we just started to imagine what would most serve the one I made vows to a long time ago? It would revolutionize everything if we just imagined for a moment, what would I want them to do for me? It is possible that we might beg off obedience to Jesus under the auspices of thinking, you know what, it's just too complicated. I don't know how to do that. And Jesus is saying, you know what, it is a lot less complicated than you think. And because it's a lot less complicated than you think, you have a lot less excuse to avoid obedience altogether. But there is more to this obedience than just simplicity. The next word, or the next two categories, the next two characteristics of obedience, I take from one word that you're going to find in verse 13. When Jesus says, enter by the narrow gate. And we're going to get to the imagery of the gate and the way here a little bit later. For right now, I just want you to focus on the word narrow. Because for Jesus to use that word twice, there are two characteristics of obedience that follow from that use of the word narrow. If you go to the Anatole over here on I-35 and you see the revolving door, you know, probably three people abreast could walk through the giant revolving door of the Anatole. Really easy. My kids have tried, right? Around and around. It's just enormous. But if you go to DFW and you walk through the TSA security gate, it looks almost like an Iron Maiden made for one. The pipes, you know, you've seen it. Like, what if I get stuck? There is a clear difference of purpose in those two kinds of doors. One of them is saying, come on in. And the other one is saying, I have a very different purpose for who comes in and who gets out. Two different kinds of gates. Jesus is saying, there is a way of obedience that is narrow. And it is narrow because it's difficult. And therefore, the second characteristic of this obedience is that difficult. Now, am I contradicting what I just said, something about simplicity in the first verse? No. The opposite of simplicity is not difficulty, it's complexity. Jesus is saying, life of obedience is not complex. But as we like to say around our household, that might be simple, but it ain't easy. There's a difficulty that comes with following Jesus. Why is it difficult? Why is difficulty a characteristic of obedience? For one reason, because it challenges our deepest, most reinforced instincts. If you were here during Lent, we took an extended exploration of what have come to be known as the vices, or what history has delivered to us under the grand moniker of the seven deadly sins. And we talked about why we consider them deadly. They're deadly because they're so daily. They're so readily available for us to indulge in. And moreover, the reason they're deadly is because these vices are in some way, they deliver. They give you a kind of satisfaction, however fleeting, that it doesn't require that you have to be reasoned with to be persuaded to indulge them. They just kind of come over you, and it's easy to go, yep, I'll go there. Jesus is offering us several reasons why this life would be difficult in the Sermon on the Mount. Just as a sample of what he's already said, why does Jesus spend passages earlier in the sermon about anger and about lust? Because those two impulses bubble to the surface like oil on water. We seethe, we follow salacious impulses because they appeal to something within us that we don't have to be persuaded to follow. They're almost instinctual. They just happen. That's why Jesus has to go there. Why? Why does he talk about us misusing our words? About saying things that mislead and give a false impression. Because of this, brothers and sisters, we might all do what Ryan Lochte did in Brazil if put ourselves in the same situation. We all might want to protect our reputation from a moment of weakness and therefore tell stories in order to give a false impression. He didn't have to say to himself, okay, this is what I'm going to do. He just did it. And we can too. And that's why Jesus has to speak to this. And that's why this way is difficult. Why does Jesus insist on loving your enemies? Of showing them kindness? Because to us, at first glance, that is utterly bonkers. Are you kidding me? When somebody comes at me, the first thing I want to do is protect myself. And then I want to punish them, either with my fist or with my mouth, whatever it may take. That's my first instinct. And that's why this way is difficult. And that's why Jesus has to speak to it. All that requires us to take issue with ourselves, to restrain in us what is second nature. And that has been difficult, and it always will be. But you know what, brothers and sisters? He's letting us know that on the front end. And so none of us should be too surprised that we find it difficult. If you were to leave church today through that back door, it would be no problem. You would walk, you would open, you would leave, no problem. If a Hereford cow came to that door, it might stare at it for a while and then walk away and look elsewhere because it knows I ain't getting through there. When it comes to the way of obedience, there is a sense in which we would come to what he asks of us like that cow does and think, you know what? There's no point. I'll never get through, so I'm going to give up. Jesus is saying to us, though, this, by telling us on the front end that it's difficult. Yeah, it'll be difficult, but that's no reason to give up, and it's no reason to think it's impossible. Several weeks ago, Kevin referenced a famous quote by G.K. Chesterton, who said this, "The Christian ideal has not been tried and found wanting. It's been found difficult and left untried." When we come up against the difficulty of it is to follow Jesus, our first instinct is to say, it's not worth it. I can't get through there. I can't down that gate. I can't get into that way. And Jesus says, no, difficult, not impossible. And at this point, you would think that Jesus would kind of let up here and sort of like it, make it easier for us. Like he's told us some bad news and let's get to the good news, right? Nope, he doesn't let up. Because yes, we've talked about the simplicity of obedience. Yes, we've talked about the difficulty of obedience. But thirdly, there is another aspect of the character of obedience that in some ways is a subset of it being difficult. And that third characteristic of obedience is this. Not only is it difficult, it's unpopular. There's a narrow gate, and there's the wide gate. There's a difficult way, and there's an easy way to live in this life. And part of what determines whether it's difficult or easy comes down to whether you feel like you're in good company. Jesus is saying, by using the word narrow and hard, and those who find it are few, is to say to us, the way he is outlining for us is a minority way. It will not be heralded in every quarter. It will be ridiculed and even vilified in a lot of quarters. Now, for everybody who's ever been a minority in some form or fashion, whether it's ethnically or whatever, there is a sense of solidarity that you feel, that emerges, that sort of wells up within you when you realize, you know what? I'm really in the minority here. And that sense of solidarity provides its own kind of strength or perseverance for a while. Because no matter that sense of solidarity in feeling and knowing that you're a minority, it is never enough to mitigate the sense that you really are in a minority. And in that sense, there are times where you feel like it is not worth trying to be different. I was listening to a pastor's panel of late where they were talking about the issue of what some would argue is a very hypersexualized culture. Like, that's all we talk about anymore, right? And one pastor's contribution to the conversation was, you know, it may feel unprecedented, but there's really nothing new under the sun. Yeah, there's more press, but it's not as if we've invented this issue. It's not like it came about in the 21st century. Every era has had to struggle with this issue and try to make sense of all those urges. That was one pastor's contribution. Another pastor chimed in and said, you know, that's true. However, what is new is this. The only grid that most people apply to thinking about our sexual urges is the grid of freedom. That insofar as I can maximize my freedom, that is my path to flourishing in that form of intimacy. And this pastor said, do you understand the disconnect in that kind of logic? That if one is out to maximize their freedom, then one can never experience love. One may experience the titillation of some things, but they can never experience love because love implies commitment. Love implies restraint. Love implies submission. Love implies putting a rein on your freedom. And therefore, you can have love or you can have freedom, but you can't have both. But his comment, even after outlining that logic, was this. You can say that from the hilltops. It's not going to make that way any more popular elsewhere. And Jesus is saying to us, you're going to have to be okay with that. You and I are going to have to be okay with being labeled, wow, aren't you on the fringe? Wow, aren't you on the wrong side of history? You're going to have to be okay with it. Because Jesus says, the ease that comes with the alternative way belies its doom. He says, for the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. The ease of the alternative belies its doom. But the difficulty of the way he's outlining belies its glory. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. With all due respect to Robert Frost, here are two ways. And one is less traveled. And that way makes all the difference. Which makes this final characteristic all the more pivotal. Because if you're going to understand the character of obedience, you have to understand not only its simplicity or its difficulty or even its unpopularity. You've got to understand something else that holds it all together. In the way that Jesus outlines, he's given us three characteristics also. But there's something more fundamental, a characteristic that follows the imagery that he's used in the whole paragraph. He's not just talking about principles. He uses evocative language. And what is that imagery? He's spoken of a gate, and he's spoken of a way. A gate, as you know, is an entrance. That's how you get in, right? A way is the space into which that entrance opens. And Jesus speaks of both, not one or the other. You enter by the narrow gate. You proceed in the narrow way. What's with the imagery? Why is he employing that language? Several years ago, a theologian by the name of Richard Lovelace wrote a book called The Dynamics of the Spiritual Life. And I forgot to put it on the front of your bulletin, so my bad. I'm going to quote it to you. But Richard Lovelace said in that book this, redemption is participatory, not imitative. And then he goes on to say, it's grounded in grace, appropriated through faith, not merely on obedience. Spiritual life flows out of union with Christ. Stand by to Advent. Here it comes. That's what we'll be talking about. Spiritual life flows out of union with Christ, not merely imitation of Christ. Okay. Interesting little distinction there. What in the world is he getting at by that pithy distinction? When he uses the word redemption there, he's talking about us being transformed. Transformed more into the image and the likeness of his Son, and therefore walking in the way, living as he did, following in the way that Jesus did. The way of obedience, he says, is not merely looking at Jesus as a model. He is our model, but he is more to us than a model. And let me flesh that out by appealing to something that's been on everybody's mind for the last 5 or 6 weeks ago. You may have caught wind in the wake of the end of the Olympics that there are a lot of Olympians who are now reporting a profound bout of depression. Even the ones that won, like 4 years ago, Michael Phelps wins, you know, his 45th and 6th gold medal. Okay, not that many. He wins all those gold medals. And he finishes the 2012 Olympics. And what happens? His bottom falls out. And he doesn't know what to live for anymore. And that experience is now sort of percolating through any number of Olympians. And you didn't even have to lose to be depressed. You could have won. What's up with that? Why is that? These Olympians, they have followed a way for years. They have given themselves and strengthened their aptitudes and their skills to no end. And both those who won and lost now feel existentially lost. They learn to imitate a certain expectation. They learn to imitate a standard by which they might excel. And when it was gone, they were gone. When it was lost, they found themselves lost. Jesus is a model to us, but if I may employ a certain metaphor that's similar, he is also our medal. Our M-E-D-A-L medal. He himself is our most prized possession. In John chapter 10, when he speaks of himself, of the good shepherd, he speaks of those who hear the shepherd's voice and they find pasture. And in that same parable, he says, they must enter by the door. And then he himself says, I'm that door. I'm the door into the fold. And you must enter by me. He is that way. He is that door. He is that gate into the wider place of safety. And therefore, for Jesus to say, enter by the narrow gate and proceed in the narrow way, that does mean we must imitate him. But for Jesus to say that we must enter by the gate into that way, and then after say to himself that he is the door into that pasture, then the character of obedience is first of all entrusting ourselves to him before we ever think about walking in his way. He has to be our medal before he can ever be our model. For Jesus to be a door, to be that gate into the way of simplicity and difficulty and unpopularity is qualitatively different from just studying him and then doing what he did. It is more than just getting better through practice. It is finding something that is not within us so that something might be born from within us, such that whether we follow him or fail him, we still belong to him because he's our medal. Because he is the one who ran the race. He is the one for whom, for the joy set before him, endured the cross and suffered the shame. And that's why I have on the front of your bulletin a quote from Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who said this: As long as I recognize the road as the one I am commanded to walk and try to walk it in fear of myself, it truly is impossible. But if I see Jesus Christ walking ahead of me, step by step, if I only look at him and follow him step by step, then I will be protected on this path. He is saying the character of our obedience is not merely an ethic, it's a fellowship. It's a fellowship with him, a fellowship with the Spirit, a fellowship with the church. That's why we join the church, because we have to be in fellowship with the church in order to walk as he did. Not that we so we might merely imitate him, but that we might draw upon the resources that he's given us through word and spirit and community. Eleanor Cliff is a wonderful author. She's been the moderator of a blog site called The Toast. She's now moved on to other things. She lived for many years as an atheist, and 2 years ago she became a Christian. And she became a Christian by reading the works in part of Henry Nouwen, which would always make her weep. And she in part came to Christ in reading the works of Dallas Willard, which would always make her weep. But in particular, she recalls a writing, a remembrance about Dallas Willard after he died, in an article and a eulogy written by Dallas Willard's associate and pastor and friend, John Ortberg. John Ortberg recalls a time when somebody asked Dallas Willard, "Do you believe in total depravity?" And Dallas Willard said, "I believe in sufficient depravity." And they said, "What is that?" And Dallas Willard said, "I believe that every human is sufficiently depraved such that when we get to heaven, no one will be able to say, 'I merited this.'" Two roads appear in this passage. And there is a road that is less traveled, Jesus says. But should we walk in that way, even well, we will all, like Dallas Willard, approach the throne of grace and still have to say, "I never merited this." And that's because Jesus is our medal before he's our model. He lives and dies and rises to be the gate into what then are the way and lords of life. And in seeing him as that gate, we find a compulsion to walk in a narrow way. And that, brothers and sisters, will make all the difference. Amen.